right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we got a packed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a couple of segments on Black history. That's because it's Black History Month, and we'll hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about Emmett Till and Jim Crow, Black people lived under a death sentence. Now, this is an excerpt from a talk he gave back in 2003, and it's a video entitled Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. Before that, we're going to be hearing an interview I did with Joshua Bloom about his book, Black Against Empire. This is a book about the history and politics of the Black Panther Party. It's a book he wrote with Waldo Martin, and Black Against Empire is a comprehensive overview and analysis of the history and politics of the Panthers, and it helped reveal the explosive growth of this revolutionary movement of the 1960s and the key role that the BPP, the Black Panther Party, played in that in a way that hasn't been brought out before. And right now, we're marking the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party, and lots is being written about the Panthers. Stanley Nelson has an excellent new movie that's being screened on PBS, so this is a good time to give another listen to this interview with Joshua Bloom. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about something that's been all over the news. Both scientists and non-scientists are really excited about it, and so am I. On Thursday, February 11th, a worldwide team of scientists announced the first direct observation of gravitational waves. And this is a major scientific achievement. It directly confirms predictions of Einstein's general theory of relativity made 100 years ago and opens up a whole new branch of astronomical investigation, a new window to understanding the entire universe, really. So, you know, you're sitting around, you're saying, what can we talk about? What can we do on the show? And somebody says, hey, what about this universe thing? You say, yeah, they just didn't just pop. They just did it. They made this, there was this discovery. And I was really pleased about that. And I really wanted to understand more of it myself. And so we hooked up with Joshua Smith, who directs the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center and is an associate professor of physics at Cal State University Fullerton. And we hooked up with Josh to talk with us about the significance of all this. Josh, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you very much for having me on.
Good. We're off to a great start. Let's jump in, man, because I got so many questions. You're going to be tired by the time we're done this interview, okay? Why all the excitement about what exactly happened and why all the excitement about gravitational waves? What actually are they? And why are people excited about discovering them?
All right. So I think the excitement starts 100 years ago. Einstein predicted gravitational waves 100 years ago, but he thought they'd be too small for us to ever measure them. If you fast forward, we've improved technology enough in the last 100 years that we now have a chance, and we've actually done it. And then I think the reason they're so exciting is because they give us a completely new way to look at the universe. As you said, they open a new window. We look at the universe every day with light and all its different forms, radio, X-rays, gamma rays, visible light with all different types of telescopes. Well, gravity tells us not about how electrons or charges move, which light does. It tells us about how masses move. So we can look at things like black holes that don't give off light, and we can look at them through ripples in gravity. And gravitational waves are ripples in gravity that travel at the speed of light.
So again, though, the significance of this, what difference does it make that knowing all this make? What difference does it make?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, Einstein's theory of gravity is the most accurate theory that we have for understanding how gravity works, how the orbits work in the solar system. And we couldn't even understand Mercury's orbit accurately until Einstein improved upon the existing theory that Newton had. So Newton said two masses have a force between them that depends on their masses and inversely proportional to the square of their separation. And Einstein said it's more like a curved rubber sheet where a mass will curve that sheet and the amount of curvature you get is proportional to how strong the gravity is, and that keeps the planets in their orbits. So by understanding Einstein's theory better, we can understand gravity better, which is one of the major forces in the universe. The other thing that it gives us is a new way to do astronomy. So that's something that, you know, everyone can partake in. And right now we're using LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, to see black holes from across the universe.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into that in a minute, but I want to continue along this other line a little bit because, one of the things I keep thinking, and I know it's not just me, but it's like people who don't have, I mean, I'm very interested in science and I know some things about science and I don't consider myself completely ignorant around it or something. And I'm actually very interested in learning about it. But actually trying to get my head around, you know, this whole idea of why these waves are significant. You talked about it. Okay, it's Einstein's theory and it proved that. You know, he talked about this 100 years ago. You know, but how does this all fit together? I mean, how does it, again, it's sort of like we're looking at it and it's important for people to understand how the universe works. But it's sort of to fit in this like thing that was sort of a momentary chirp. To people who were reading the paper, it was a momentary chirp. And it's sort That's of like, right. you know, well, why is everybody, why are all you guys out there jumping up and down and screaming and having parties?
I think it's because we don't think of it as a momentary chirp. We think of it as maybe that first radio transmission that was ever sent, or the first form of a new type of communication or a new sense for humanity. So this first chirp was signaling that our detectors work well and can sense this type of signal from across, you know, from a billion light years away. But this won't be the last thing that we find. This actually is the first of many things that we'll see using this new type of technology. So I think the reason why we're jumping up and down isn't only because we've shown Einstein's theory to be accurate in this one area, but also because we feel like it's the start of a new way to do this science.
Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, I want to get into that, but I'm building up to it, man. Okay, Josh, because it's, you know, so many questions. It's sort of it's exactly what you want, you know, when you actually have this kind of something of this magnitude, and you're actually getting people who really want to understand what's happening this site. Now, again, let me ask this again. How do, you know, you talked about Einstein's theory about gravity and all this stuff, but how could you explain to me in a simple way, how do gravitational waves fit into that theory?
Sure. So in Einstein's theory, where he said that kind of mass makes a curvature in space and time, that's Einstein's general theory of relativity. He also has a special theory of relativity that says nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. What that means is, if you move a mass, like let's say that we made the sun disappear, or better, maybe we had two stars rotating around each other. If you were far away from that system, information about the mass that had moved couldn't get to you faster than the speed of light. And so Einstein's theory made it necessary to have some sort of wave, which in this case is very similar to like a ripple on a pond. Imagine you drop a stone into a pond. The stone changes the surface of the water, and the waves ripple out from that. This is very similar, except dropping the stone, instead of that, you'd have something like a star exploding. The waves would ripple out from that at the speed of light and provide information about the change in the curvature of space-time. So it's necessary, both for his special theory of relativity and his general theory of relativity, to have waves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, why are they so hard to find? People have been searching them for quite some time, right? And it's since Einstein sort of said he predicted them, but then people have been trying to find them, and they've been extremely difficult to find, right?
That's right. So in Einstein's original papers, he predicted they'd be hard to find. He had an equation, and he said if you take this equation for the amplitude of gravitational waves and you put in any practical numbers you can think about, the amplitude of gravitational waves will be practically vanishing. But Einstein didn't have in mind systems like two black holes going around each other. Those systems weren't known to him at the time. And also, Einstein didn't know the leaps that technology would take in the meantime. So in the 60s, people started looking for ways to detect gravitational waves. And since then, the sensitivity has improved by orders and orders of magnitude. And a lot of that is pushing technology like lasers and mirrors and vacuum systems and seismic isolation, and also technology from the world, from companies, industry, developing and being put back into science. So us using developments that, you know, were made in industry. And those things come together, the fact that you have these amazing astronomical objects and you have this great new technology to make the most sensitive instruments ever. And they need to sense incredibly tiny waves, because the objects that are producing these big waves far away, by the time the waves reach us, they're very, very small. Because they spread out as a sphere from the source.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Smith. And Josh he directs the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center and is an associate professor of physics at California State University in Fullerton. And Josh, you were working on this whole process, right?
That's right. So I have a team of students and professors here at Cal State Fullerton, but I'm also part of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. It has about 1,000 people working on this, and they're all around the world. Mm-hmm. So a number of universities and funded by the National Science Foundation. And yes, I've been working on this for 15 years. Some of my colleagues have spent their lifetime working on this. And so the February 11th announcement was a major day in many of our lives.
Big party, huh?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, now tell me something. I read something that kind of struck me, and it was because it was said just in such plain language, and it was just so straightforward. It said, you know, we were just talking about how hard, why they were so hard to find. But there was also something that like a million different things could happen that could screw up the search for that, like a, just make a blip or cause something that, you know, that just to disguise it or you know, be out there and not be what you're looking for, that there are a million different ways that this thing could have been missed. That was kind of intriguing to me because you know, you guys fought through on this and you developed the technology to actually fight through on this, but there still was like a noise coming from someplace or something else coming from someplace could have just completely turned things off. And this was sort of something you really had to use a scientific method very deeply and very profoundly in order to actually continue working on it and also to be able to sum up when you have actually made the discovery, right?
Hey, that's a great point. I mean, this event happened in September and we didn't announce it until February. And one of the primary things we were doing between September and February was vetting the event. And you're right, locally, there are a lot of disturbances that can couple into the detectors. The detectors can be affected by earthquakes, by even much smaller things, by local, we call it anthropogenic noise, by people walking around and cars driving. But we have a couple of things working in our favor, and this was designed this way so we could make a confident detection. We have two detectors. One is in Livingston, Louisiana, and one is in Hanford, Washington. They're separated by about as far as we could get them, given the land that we needed to purchase. And that means that it's much easier to find coincident signals that aren't local disturbances. It's harder to have things that will couple into such widely separated detectors. And then the second thing that we can do is when we have a signal, we can compare that signal to what we expect for waveforms from the sources calculated with general relativity, with Einstein's theories. So here at Fullerton, we have students and professors that use supercomputers to model what happens when two black holes collide. And they use those waveforms along with the LIGO Scientific Collaboration to match the data that we see. And this particular signal was an excellent match, whereas most of the blips and blops that you talked about, local noise and things like that, are very poor matches. And that gives us a lot of confidence. But we still spent many months making sure that this was real and checking everything that we could.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was wondering about, too, this laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory, you know, and how it found these waves. You're speaking to that to a certain degree now, but it's actually really, it just amazed me because this is something that was brand new, right? I mean, this was a, you know, when you look at like the various videos of what this thing looks like and how people actually figured out to do this. It's actually not the thing that you, when somebody says, well, we're working with telescopes or we're doing this or we're doing that, or we have an observatory and people are looking at it and think about like something almost out of cartoons where you're standing there, you're looking in a telescope and you're looking out into space. But you guys actually designed something that was very particular in terms of finding this kind of thing. And it was something that was brand new, right?
Well, that's right. So it is very particular. Gravitational waves, the way we can measure them is that gravitational waves, when they pass through you, they stretch space-time. So if a gravitational wave passes through the Earth, it stretches it in one direction and squishes it in the other. And we can use that property to make the measurement. So we built detectors that have very long arms, 2.5 miles, 4-kilometer-long arms. And what I mean by arms is at each end of those 2.5-mile vacuum tubes, they're like big tunnels, there are mirrors. And in between the mirrors, we shine a laser beam, and it very accurately measures the distance between the mirrors. And we make it an L shape, so like when I said the Earth gets squashed and squished in different directions, one part of the L gets squished and the other gets lengthened, and a little bit of light from the interference of light will come out and we'll measure it at a photodetector. So we use laser light to very accurately measure the distances, and we look for passing waves. And this is called an interferometer, and you're absolutely right. It's not like looking into a telescope. We don't get an image of the system. It's more like we record a waveform from the system. So it's something a little bit more like a microphone. And by recording the waveform with multiple detectors, we can get confidence that it came, you know, that they were coincident at the two detectors within the travel time of gravitational waves. And we can get information in where the sky it came from. But we don't form a picture. We more measure like a sound. It's not a sound. It's a wave form of gravity.
Wow. Now this LIGO is, as I understand it, is only working at 1/3 of its potential right now.
Yeah, that's right. And this is, I think, another part of the reason why we're all so excited about this. So I mentioned we thought that this was the first of hopefully many signals. That's part of the reason. When we make LIGO more sensitive, that 1/3 of its sensitivity is talking about the distance that LIGO can see. But looking out into the universe, when you make the distance longer, you're actually expanding the distance along a whole sphere. So you would cube that distance that you're going to make it more sensitive, and we would expect to see 27 times the number of sources if it just gets three times more sensitive in distance.
Wow. That's...
So there are engineers and scientists at the LIGO sites that are working right now to improve the detectors. We've taken the detectors offline. We're going to perform analyses on the remaining data and publish those. But right now, the detectors are being improved further and will hopefully come online in the summer with even better sensitivity and start another run.
All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Smith. He directs the Gravitational Wave Physics and Astronomy Center and is an associate professor of physics at California State University in Fullerton. Let me ask you this, and this is kind of a strange question because it involves some philosophy, too, in terms of epistemological approaches to things. As I read, preparing for this interview, as I read about all this, I kept thinking that there's something here about, you went into this, you guys all had to go into this. And again, it's also related to the scientific method question. You know, you went into this thinking, okay, Einstein had talked about gravitational waves. And, you know, it was a sort of like, okay, it's kind of, you know, we want to prove that these exist. But you weren't going in to prove something. Your approach to the examining the universe wasn't so that we can find this. It was actually, if they exist, we're aiming to find them. If they don't, though, we'll also have to deal with that, because you couldn't approach this as sort of like, well, you know, we know what we're going to find, and we're just doing this to sort of like find what we know we'll already find. You're actually exploring what was going on in a part of the universe that really hadn't been examined in the way that you examined it. And you had to be open to actually whatever it was that you would find, right?
I think that's right. I will say that I think we took a safe bet. Einstein's theory has been right in every way that we've tested it. And in 1993, there was a Nobel Prize awarded to Hulson Taylor, who discovered a system of neutron stars called pulsars that were orbiting around each other. And later work, which is continuing even today, saw that these two neutron stars were behaving as though, by making their orbits went around, their orbit got smaller and smaller, and they behaved as though they were emitting gravitational waves, and it precisely agreed with Einstein's theory. Mm-hmm. So we had very good information that gravitational waves do exist, but nobody had ever set up a detector to catch them. So I think we took a safer bet in that sense. But you're absolutely right that within the error bars of our knowledge, we did not know that we would see black holes. We did not know that we would see them so early. And we were all very excited and pleasantly surprised to see two black holes the size 30 times the mass of the sun orbiting around each other a fraction of the speed of light at a billion light years away. That was an unexpected source, or at least it was on the optimistic end of what we expected. And that we didn't take a safe bet on that astrophysics. And I think we've made out very well, and it looks like nature's been very kind, and we're going to have a lot of interesting things to look at with our gravitational wave detectors.
Yeah, I'll say. I want to follow up with you often, okay? Tell me this, you know, because again, if you hadn't been able to detect these, that actually would have, I mean, we're going to talk in a minute about what actually happened, what's the result of having discovered this, but if you hadn't been able to detect these gravitational waves, or if they didn't exist, if somehow you managed to prove that they didn't exist to a certain extent, that would have thrown a whole hell of a lot of physics and astronomy into question right now, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And a lot of times I've heard my colleagues over the years say, you know, it might be the most interesting result if we don't detect anything. I didn't agree with them. I'm really happy that we started this new field of astronomy. But that's right. So scientists, of course, I think one of the most exciting things in life, and especially in science, is when you find out something that you really don't know, or you find out something that isn't quite right. It's an opportunity to learn more about the universe. And if we had found that some of our theories weren't quite right, the hard way, by not detecting something, that might have actually been a lead in another direction. I'm really happy that that's not the case, but you're right, and I'm very happy that, you know, the National Science Foundation supported this project, and that we've had, you know, so many colleagues around the world that have worked so hard to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and there's also a lesson that people at large can learn about. I mean, in terms of pursuing the truth without fearing what that might be, actually, because whatever you can find that's true, whatever you can understand that's, and find that's true, actually can help you, you know, in a certain sense. And one, just by knowing it, you know, even if it's something that's a terrible truth and you have to go back and, oh my God, Einstein was a crackpot, you know, but you'd have to, you know, you'd have to figure out, you couldn't just give up. You'd actually have to, that would, you know, better that you found that out than never found it out and you were pursuing something that was completely wrong, but instead you found something very different. And I thought that was actually, in terms of epistemology, that was pretty important in terms of the approach that people take, because, you know, science can't be a subjective, it's not a subjective thing. You know, it's not something that what's true and what isn't is based on who's doing the observing. You know, it's got to be actually subjective. It's very, and that's very important. I thought that was really something that you guys, you know, you put a lot on the line pursuing this in a certain sense. And actually now you've got this whole other thing that's opened up, and let's talk about that. What actually has opened up? People are talking about, you've mentioned it, there's a whole new, in a certain way, there's a whole new level of science that's been unleashed right now. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so I think the big change that's happened is that recently there's been a rebirth in astronomy where people are looking at astronomy through other channels. It started with light, and then you looked at light in all of the parts of the light spectrum, from gamma rays to radio waves. And you found different things whenever you looked in those different channels. In the past decades, people have started looking at other particles like neutrinos and doing astronomy with other channels. Now, what we've done here is opened up a way to look at the universe with gravity. And you can look at objects that don't give off light, but you can learn about them based on their motion of their masses. Or you can look at objects that do give off light, but you can see a different side of them because you can see what their mass is doing, not necessarily just what their charges are doing like you learn from light. So I think with this first signal, we've seen the first glimpse of that. And as the detectors get more and more sensitive, we'll probe farther out into space and hopefully see different types of sources. And we'll start to be able to do this new style of astronomy based on gravity. And, you know, there are things there that you can learn that you just can't learn from light.
Mm-hmm. And actually, there's a certain point, and maybe I think I'm correct, my understanding is correct in this. There's actually a point where actually you wouldn't be able to investigate the parts of the universe that based on light, because there's no light there, or it's too, you know, muddy or whatever. And this thing of being able to actually go back all the way back, perhaps to the Big Bang, has a lot to do with this whole new way of these gravitational waves providing a view, a way to view all this. That was pretty mind-blowing there.
Yeah, that's right. So cosmologists think, and I'm not a cosmologist, but we have a lot of really smart people that are looking into this. Cosmologists think that in the evolution of the universe, there was a period where the universe was opaque, so light couldn't pass through it. And so that's like a wall on how far back in time we can look with light. Gravitational waves, because they couple, so gravitational waves are so weak and they're so hard for us to measure here on Earth because they couple so weakly to things. Coupling means you have a wave, how much of it can you grab or how much energy can you extract from it? They couple very, very weakly, which means that they pass right through objects. Our detectors on one side of the Earth or the other side of the Earth, there's no shielding from the Earth. Gravitational waves can't be jammed. They pass right through things. And that means they provide an opportunity for us to look back farther in time because of how they pass through things.
Wow.
And so we have a group of people involved in the LIGO Scientific Collaboration that are looking at gravitational waves from what we call stochastic sources, from kind of rumbling sources from the time of the early universe, from the Big Bang. And there are also other projects that are going to have sensitivity in other frequency ranges to sort of fill in the gravitational wave spectrum. LISA in space, and also pulsar timing. And those projects will also be looking for what you mentioned, gravitational waves from the very earliest moments of the universe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool. One more question. This is more a reaction from you on this. I can't say the person's name, Zsabolcs Márka, a member of the LIGO
yes.
team. And there's a quote from them that says, "Until this moment, we had our eyes in the sky and we couldn't hear the music." And I thought the poetry of that in relation to what we've been talking about is, it's pretty intense. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
It's a beautiful way to put it. And another way that I've heard that actually a person that I was speaking with yesterday said is that humanity has gained another sense through this discovery. I think that's apt. Although we've only seen one event so far, it's a new sense that we have. We use our tools to sense it, but we can now sense the ripples in gravity from faraway objects like black holes. And I think that's really amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Joshua Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and keep us in mind as you go along discovering these things, because we'll be back in touch, man, all right?
That would be excellent.
All right, Josh.
I will do that.
All right, thanks a lot, man.
All right, we've just been talking with Joshua Smith, who's a professor at Cal State Fullerton, and he has been part of a whole international project to find and verify the existence of gravitational waves, something that Einstein predicted a whole hell of a long time ago when he first began to develop his theories.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Joshua Bloom about his book, Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. Something's in the air. That's how I felt after reading my next guest's book. It reminded me of all that stuff when I actually lived there, lived in that time, and felt, yeah, something is in the air. Revolution's in the air. And joining us now to talk about that period, and in particular, a very important aspect of it, the Black Panther Party, is Joshua Bloom. Joshua is a fellow at the Ralph J. Bunche Center at UCLA and the collection editor of the Black Panther newspaper collection. He's also the co-author with Waldo E. Martin Jr. of a really important new book, Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Sure. Joshua or Josh?
Either way is fine.
Well, save us a little time if I say Josh, okay?
Yeah, Josh is fine in conversation.
Okay. First, I have to tell you that this book, I mean, I sat down and read this thing in like 3.5 days. I was just, had to force myself to put it down. It is such a powerful book and such a unique book. And one of the things that I really appreciated about it was the fact that, as you say in the introduction, it was done as a political history. That one of the things that you wanted to do was, you wanted to actually make a political history of the Panthers, which, well, that's it. I'll ask you why.
Well, you know, the party has had a fair amount of attention. There's been not only memoirs, but people have written different aspects and pieces of the history. But it's really been hard to make sense of what the politics of the party was. And it's sort of a puzzle. I mean, it's always hard to figure out histories. But why, you know, why has there been so much attention, and why for such an organization that was so important and so formative in the late 60s and into the early 70s, why hasn't anyone really, you know, figured out and sat down and really worked through the politics of the party? You know, I think there's a lot of causes and it's complicated, but, you know, a lot of what's been written has really been obfuscation and mystification. And a lot of that comes directly out of the repressive effort to not only attack and repress the party as an organization, but really to obscure and complicate its history.
Well, isn't it part and parcel, maybe even the leading edge of a lot of the attempt to actually rewrite the entire history of the 60s? I mean, it's phenomenal, the kinds of things that are just suddenly reversed. Everything is reversed. Suddenly everything, if you were living there or you were even in that time period and you were honest and you followed what was going on, if you look at a lot of the stories that are told today, the histories, the films, all these things, the idea that people really weren't serious, they were just out for a joyride, that everybody was an opportunist, you get a very different sense in your book. And that's what I really appreciate about it in terms of it taking on the political history of the Black Panther Party, because it's actually something that shows you how these folks developed, why they developed, what was the need for them. And you talk about one thing. You say that what set the BPP apart was that the emergence of the Panthers in many ways marked a break with most of what preceded it in the Black movement and in the whole movement overall. Let's talk about that a little, because that's sort of the thing about what set them apart with their politics, which actually did entail a break with a lot of what had gone before it and a lot of other things that were out there at the same time.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you read a book like Hugh Pearson's Shadow of the Panther, which was recognized as one of the most important books of the year by the New York Times in 1994, it basically takes the politics out of the party, right? And it looks at sort of what is all the sort of criminal allegations that we can either find or dig up or create, right? A lot of it's not very well substantiated. But this kind of attempt to criminalization was really a key part of, you know, Hoover's thinking, J. Edgar Hoover, very explicitly talked talking about the real threat of not only the armed self-defense, but the breakfast programs and the service programs, specifically because they reached to broader alliances. So what we were really trying to figure out is, why does the Black Panther Party in revolutionary politics, and a politics that's so distinct from civil rights politics, that, you know, you think about the success of the civil rights movement in the early 60s at really dismantling Jim Crow and its claims for participation in America, and its turn the other cheek nonviolence, and its civil disobedience, sort of bodily challenging, but in a very nonviolent, very explicitly nonviolent way, Jim Crow and formal caste subordination. Why, at the height of the success of the civil rights movement, do you get a real sea change, really, and the emergence in the late 60s of the Black Panther Party really becoming the center of Black freedom struggle and Black insurgent mobilization, where people are saying, you know, no, we don't want to be a part of America. We need to overthrow America. And in fact, we need to be able to govern our own communities. And in part, we're going to have to take up guns and do that through an unarmed revolutionary process. So really trying to make sense of why this distinct politics has become so powerful in the late 60s.
Well, it's really interesting, too, because part of the thing is, you know, when you look at this, this point that you just alluded to, the point of a lot of the civil rights organizations, the whole movement, was really much more about, we're going to participate in America. We want our full participation in America. And yet what the Panthers came out, and this separated them off not just from the civil rights movement, but also from a lot of the other organizations that were out there and trends that were out there in the world at that time. It set them apart in the sense of, they said, look, we don't accept the legitimacy. The very idea of the legitimacy of the U.S. government and the U.S. system is, no, sorry, we're not going for it. That was a pretty heavy sea change there.
Absolutely. And, you know, you think about the moment, and there's really a change that happens leading up to the formation of the Black Panther Party with the call for Black power. And it really is like this question. And I was surprised when we started going through the archives and even just looking at some of the organizations that Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were working with at Oakland, but same in LA. If you look at the organizations in LA around the Black Congress, or if you look at what was happening in New York or Chicago or other major cities throughout the country with large Black populations, people had seen the civil rights movement. They had seen the power of people standing up to change their circumstances. They'd seen the success of Black freedom struggle, but they hadn't been able to really make inroads into challenging poverty, into challenging ghettoization in the cities. You know, you had had these major growth of Black communities in the North and the West and urbanization. And those jobs that had drawn people in World War II had left with white flight, and the municipalities had responded basically through containment policing. And so, yeah, the Black Panther Party was part of a range of organizations that were asking, how do we build Black power? How do we build political and economic power that really addresses those conditions in the city? And they were not the only ones to sort of take this revolutionary stance. You know, they were in many ways building on organizations like the Revolutionary Action Movement that had taken a very similar anti-imperialist position and said, we need to challenge the imperialist power of the United States and create our own forms of governance. But they took those ideas and made them into a practical politics that was really powerful in a way like nothing else in that period.
I want to talk about that, but first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Joshua Bloom, who's the co-author of The Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party, and it's put out by the University of California Press, Berkeley. Really remarkable book. I would really suggest everybody get this book, man. It's like you're going to learn so much and, you know, put so much in perspective in a certain way. And I think even the framework for the 60s is people are reminded of what the framework actually was, you know, and that's one of the things I thought was really important. And I want to sort of pursue that line of thought. But starting with the point that you just made, that in early 1968, you make this point repeatedly throughout the book. In early 1968, the Panthers were still a sort of an organization on the block. They were in Oakland, they were small, they had some influence in Oakland, but in a little while, in a matter of months, their membership mushroomed. And in a lot of ways, they were put in a position they never expected to be in. You know, they became the most serious challenge to the whole U.S. empire that ever existed, probably. And the thing is that they had, this point you just said about it was partly a question of their ideas, but it was more than their ideas. It was what they actually did in the context, in the face of the conditions that they faced. The actual ideas and the implementation of those ideas. Let's talk about that and the difference that made for people.
Well, you know, you can have an idea about sort of the problems of the state and the problems of imperialism, but that's very different than moving people. And what the Black Panther Party did, there were a number of people asking these questions in different ways, but they figured out ways of actually building the power through disruption by making business as usual impossible. How do you tap that power of disruption? How do you do it in a way that really speaks to people's heart where they're at and can sustain a source of power to build movement? We think of sort of developmental organizing, and there's all kinds of people, you know, all the time who are really going out there and building networks and building organization. And that's really important work. And there was a lot of that in the Black Panther Party as well. But when we look at movements like the civil rights movement or like the revolutionary black nationalism and the Black Panther Party in the late 60s, or you think of industrial unionism in the 1930s, or, you know, you name your movement, the real power for mobilization comes out of tapping the power of disruption. People who don't have necessarily institutionalized power to change things to address their interests within the society as it's established oftentimes are able to really make a change by making business as usual impossible. And the question is, how do you sustain that kind of challenge? And what Huey Newton and Bobby Seale did on a very local level first in Oakland was that they recognized that there was power in the resistance and the frustration and the anger of poor and working class blacks in resistance to police brutality. And they really saw that confrontation of young black people to police as a potential political force. And they were looking at the Watts Rebellion and other rebellions that were going on. And they said, we need to figure out how to tap that. So it wasn't just the idea of revolution and the idea of anti-imperialism and Malcolm X's idea of the black community and self-determination and, you know, we're going to be the stewards of the black community. It was, how do we connect that to what people are really experiencing on the street and how do we build power? And so what they started to do, and they took notes and in some ways copied the Community Alert Patrol down here in L.A. that was built after the Watts Rebellions, they started patrolling the police, but doing it with arms. So that instead of having their tape recorders and their cameras snatched and taken away by the police, they were able to actually confront the police in these public environments in front of Merritt College, at the airport in San Francisco, in front of the Ramparts office. They had a series of confrontations with the police in these public spaces where they were armed and they were able to actually back the police down because they were following the law. And they knew the letter of the law, and they knew how to act, and they knew how to read the situation, and were able to actually have these confrontations and stand up to the police. And people saw that on a local level, and they were like, wow, this is power. This is something. And so they built a small following. Now, it was still pretty little. I don't know how much detail you want me to go through in these stages. There were a lot of different stages that the party went through where there were changes. The state of California, pretty soon you have hundreds of black people rallying on the streets in Richmond in response to the murder of Denzel Dowell, a young black man, where people are coming to the Panther rally and bringing their own guns, hundreds of people on the street corner and saying, this is our corner. You know, the police don't rule here anymore, right? And all of a sudden, the state of California says, well, we better change the law, right? So they go into the state assembly. Now it's national news. So people have heard about, by February of 68, when the second office opens in LA, people have heard of the Black Panther Party, SNCC, which was certainly one of the leading, but probably the most influential organization mobilizing direct action in the civil rights movement. They're looking for ways to be relevant post-civil rights. And so they're exploring a merger with the Black Panther Party. They've heard about what happened in Sacramento. They've heard about what happened in Richmond. They're trying to figure out, how do we build black power? So February 68, an office opens in LA. But what really changes things and sort of puts the Panthers at the center of black politics is the assassination of Martin Luther King. And, you know, young people in these cities throughout the country who have been saying, how do we build black power? And have been looking what the Panthers are doing in Oakland and then in California are like, okay, you know, the nonviolence and claims for participation just are not going to do what it takes. And so very quickly, you have dozens of cities by the end of the year that open up Panther offices with hundreds of members in most of those cities dedicating their lives to the revolution.
Now, Joshua. Really important point, because people don't really even get that today. The people were actually dedicating their lives to the revolution that they saw as real. And it was real, you know, in a very important sense. And I think actually one of the things, too, that I wanted to explore, because the Panthers had such a broad impact in society. It's sort of like living example of the whole idea that when revolution has its day, the people think a whole different way. The influence that the Panthers had broadly, I mean, something I didn't even realize was the influence the Panthers had on the radicalization of the student movement. Really, really important. And not just black students, but white students, all, you know, the whole student movement, the idea that anti-draft activism was actually the way people should be going, that one of the important things people should be taking up, that they're saying they're anti-imperialist, which was one old struggle, then if you are and you want to stand with the people of the world, you have to be against the draft, you know, or otherwise you're complicit in a certain sense. So it was really, really remarkable, the influence the Panthers had in society as a whole and what that did to change the whole climate in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that, you know, there's all this talk about framing and frame alignment and sort of the power of ideas and how you have to talk to the moment. And I think that sometimes there's a way that people get the causal relationship backwards, that ideas are very important, but ideas alone, they need some kind of grounding in real politics to be able to move people. And so you had people talking revolution from, you know, in trying to organize in black communities from, you know, very early in the 60s and, you know, and earlier, of course, but on some significant level with the Revolutionary Action Movement from the early 60s. And it wasn't really moving people. And what happened was that when the party really was able to situate itself really at this juncture where you have broad, moderate black political organizations who, organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League even, who, while they very much do not support Black Panthers' politics and their revolutionary vision, also are completely frustrated with, you know, the high incarceration rates of black young black people, the lack of access to higher education, the lack of employment by the government. You look at fire departments and police departments in predominantly black neighborhoods and cities, and they were all white during that period. Very little incorporation into the democratic local machines, let alone federal representation. Only 6 congressmen, you know, at the time that the party was starting, only 6 congressmen nationally, black congressmen, had ever been, you know, sort of elected at one time. So you have a situation where moderate black political organizations aren't getting what they need. At the same time, and this is really crucial, right? The Vietnam War, right, is pretty unpopular already, and people don't understand why they've got to go fight and be drafted and die for this war, right? And yet you look at 1966, right? And as late as 66, there's very little draft resistance. You have these little pockets, right? But it hasn't taken off on the campuses. And it's actually not the Panthers, it's Stokely Carmichael and SNCC that say, hey, if you all want to be relevant, you know, and they're talking to SDS very specifically, and SDS isn't that big at this point. If you want to be relevant, you have to start resisting the draft. And that's where people are really going to listen to you. And what black revolutionary nationalism and anti-imperialism gives to a broader anti-draft movement is it gives some very local, real legitimacy, right? It's one thing to say, oh, we don't want to go fight in this war because we don't want to die. That's traitorous, right? And there were people who were, you know, being jailed and also beaten on the streets, right, for these kinds of positions, certainly, you know, in the Korean War and in World War II, but also in the beginning of the Vietnam War. But what happens is with the black movement moving towards an anti-imperialist position and really the Panthers galvanizing that, this politics becomes a real reference point. And people who are, you know, not wanting to go and fight this war can say, hey, I'm anti-imperialist too, because, you know, you look at the Democrats, right, at that period, 68, right, the Democratic Convention, 80% of Democrats vote to end the war and end the draft, right? But what does the party machine do? It pushes through a pro-war platform and a pro-war candidate.
What?
Right?
The Democrats?
The Democrats, right? The Democratic Party, right? They're not listening to the constituency, right? And so this anti-imperialist position really becomes a way for people to have a political voice. And it's through that practical politics. It's by creating a political position which can draw support that the ideas shift. Revolution as an idea becomes real because it has power in the street.
Let me ask you this, and this is going to, I'm going to combine two questions here. And one of the things your book does an excellent job of detailing the unparalleled repression that the Panthers came up with. And before I get into that, let me remind people again that I'm talking with Joshua Bloom, who is one of the co-authors of Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party from the University of California Press, Berkeley, a really remarkable book, an important book. Make sure you don't miss it, all right? Pick it up and read it. Now, Josh, one of the things that we're going to have to combine these questions, and there's so much to talk about in here. Maybe we'll have you back some other time, but the international reach, all this other stuff that goes on. But you also mention in the book the unparalleled repression of the party. And you say something that I think is extremely important, and it ties into this whole thematic thing that we've had going on here. You say that that repression was not just against the Panthers for its practical thing, but for the promise it held for millions of people about a different kind of future. I think that's extremely important. And in particular, the whole idea of something else you mentioned at the in your conclusion of the book is that while you can't say whether something else would have happened if the Panthers didn't happen, what you can say is that without the Black Panther Party, we would now live in a very different world. Can you talk to both of those things at once?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the first point, right? I mean, Hoover's clear about this, right? I mean, you look at the memos internal to the FBI, and again, it wasn't just Hoover, right? We now have the Watergate tapes, and we can, you know, we see Nixon telling, you know, Hoover, you know, and Mitchell that we got to go after the Black Panther Party. But the approach was very clearly, we have to vilify this party, and we have to drive a wedge between the party and its potential allies. The San Francisco special agent in charge of the FBI said, wrote a memo to Hoover and says, look, we shouldn't be going after the Breakfast for Children program. It has the support of white liberals and the black church and all these points. And Hoover's very clear. He says, look, you're exactly missing the point. That's why we need to go after the program. We need to make this a political impossibility, right? You had a second question. What was your second question?
My second question is the point that you made, that the world would be a very different place without the BPP having been around.
Right. You know, and it's hard. It's hard to sort of separate all the very complex historical causalities and really in a precise way say what would have happened. But here are some things that we do know. We know that the draft was repealed and the war rolled back. We know that we got affirmative action programs. We know that we got the growth of black electoral representation, not only on a local level, but nationally. We know that there was a vast expansion of the black middle class. We know that many of these institutional responses clearly were not just responses to the Black Panther Party, but they very much were responses to a broad social destabilization in the period. And the Panthers were in many ways at the heart of that. They were not the only organization, but they were a key organization and a key part of a broad challenge to American power and imperialism as constituted. And I think we can't really understand where we are today without a draft, with large, you know, it was not during the civil rights movement, you know, that people won affirmative action and access to higher education and electoral representation, right? There's tons of problems that persist. Mm-hmm. There's tons of problems that persist, but there were some real substantive changes that happened in that period.
All right, Josh, and those problems that persist to me, actually because we weren't able to go all the way back then, that's what we really, really need to do now, is to seriously take up this whole question of revolution, nothing less, to solve the problems in this society and the world, actually. Joshua, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. All right. And the book is Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. It's from University of California Press, Berkeley. Josh, thank you very much for both an interesting discussion and a really compelling and important book. All right.
Thank you.
Take care now. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back.
So long ago, when a young boy from Chicago town walked through a southern door, this boy's fateful tragedy you should all remember well. The color of his skin was black, and his name was Emmett Till.
Welcome back. That was Emmett Till from somebody named Blind Boy Grunt, who's actually Bob Dylan.
And now we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, or B.A., the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, talking about the era of lynching and Jim Crow and the impact it had on the lives of black people, as well as on the nature of U.S. society as a whole. This is Emmett Till and Jim Crow, Black People Lived Under a Death Sentence. And it's an excerpt from a talk he gave in 2003 entitled Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. You can see a lot more of the clips of the Revolution Talk at the Revolution Talk YouTube channel, or click on the Bob Avakian section at revcom.us for the entire talk and more.
Then there's a story of Emmett Till. Emmett Till was born and grew up in Chicago. In 1955, when he had just turned 14, he went to Mississippi to visit family there. His mother warned and she schooled him about what he would find in Mississippi, what a young black male like himself should expect, what he must do and not do in order to stay alive. And think about the fact that a mother has to school her child that way just when he goes to visit family. But Emmett Till was full of life and full of fun. One day, while in Money, Mississippi, he made the fatal mistake of whistling at a white woman as he was leaving a store owned by her husband. A few days later, the store owner and his brother-in-law came in the middle of the night with guns and took Emmett Till away. They were seen beating him as they drove him away. His relatives began looking for his body along riverbanks and under bridges, where black folks always look when things like this happen, as his uncle put it. Think about that. Think about what it means, where black folks always look when this kind of thing happens. Think about what that tells you about this country. Emmett Till's body was found in a river. He was beaten and shot to death, beaten so badly he could barely be recognized even by his mother. A 14-year-old boy lynched for what? For whistling at a white woman. In an act of tremendous courage and large-mindedness, his mother, Mamie Till, displayed his body publicly in Chicago, and she refused to have it touched up so that all could see what had been done to him. His body was viewed by tens of thousands of black people in Chicago. The story of what happened to Emmett Till aroused deep anger among black people all over the country. It shocked many white people in many parts of the country, and it became an international news story and outrage. But back in Mississippi, white people rallied to the defense of the men who had kidnapped and brutally murdered Emmett Till. These men were put on trial only because of the outrage around the country and around the world. Death threats and terror against black people in the area where this lynching took place was increased, to keep them from saying what they knew and how they felt about this lynching. In a courtroom that was segregated, with white people filling the seats and the few black people who were allowed in forced to stand in the back, the jury of all white men found the murderers of Emmett Till not guilty in an hour. Their lawyers even accused Mamie Till and the NAACP of conspiring to cook up this whole story of a lynching. Actually, Emmett Till was alive in Detroit, these lawyers claimed. Not long after they were acquitted of this crime, the two men sold their story to a national magazine, telling in detail how they brutally murdered Emmett Till. But nothing was ever done to them. Despite a massive campaign calling for the federal government to indict these two men, the government refused. Sound familiar? Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was president of the United States at the time, never even answered a telegram sent to him by Mamie Till. J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, called this brutal lynching of Emmett Till an alleged murder. And he gave much more attention to investigating the involvement of communists in protesting this lynching than he ever did to the lynching itself. But the lynching of Emmett Till became a rallying cry for black people. People stood up who had never stood up before, as Mamie Till put it. In talking about these lynchings, I'm not exaggerating any of this. In fact, I have actually left out some of the most gruesome and disgusting details in talking about these lynchings, because there is only so much of this that you can stand to talk about or to hear about. And these were not the so-called isolated incidents, the way they always try to tell us whenever they get caught in one of their brutalities and murders, the way they try to cover up the real crimes of this system and those who rule it. Thousands of black people were lynched in those times, and all black people lived with a constant terror of this. Listen to the following statement by the author of a book about lynching. He said, "It is doubtful that any black male growing up in the rural South in the period 1900 to 1940 was not traumatized by a fear of being lynched." What is he saying with this? Nothing less than this. No black male growing up in the rural South in that period could be free of that fear. Every black male was haunted and scarred deeply by that fear. Think about what that means, and think about how this touched black people as a whole. A sociologist who studied black life in Mississippi in the 1930s learned how deeply the threat of lynching was in the minds of all black people, from the very young to the very old. And in a PBS program on the system of segregation in the South, which was called the Jim Crow system, they quoted a psychologist who said that every black person living in the South under Jim Crow was living actually under a death sentence. It might or might not actually get carried out, but it was always there. Black people could be killed for anything they did which might offend some white people, and the whites who killed them would never be punished. A black man could be lynched for looking at a white woman in a way that some white people thought was the wrong way, and the whites who killed him, again, would never be punished. Or a grown black man could be killed for not calling a young white boy, sir, or for not stepping off the sidewalk to make way for white people, or for any reason, or no reason at all. And this was related to the overall outrages to which black people were subjected. This experience of lynching and its effect on the masses of black people can, in a real sense, be taken as representing and concentrating the experience of black people as a whole, long after literal slavery, with all its horrors, had been ended in the 1860s.
And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of our guests today, Joshua Smith, the scientist from Cal State Fullerton, who was part of the international project to verify Einstein's prediction of the existence of gravitational waves, and they succeeded in doing so. So let's celebrate, all right? I also want to thank Joshua Bloom, who's the co-author of the book Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. And I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my intern, Alex Brenner, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And in honor of Paul Kantner from the Jefferson Airplane, who recently died, we're going to go out with Revolution from Volunteers. Talk to you again next week.